of it. She would hide until he left. As he pulled onto the lagoon shore and stepped out of the boat, he carried a white box tied up with string.
"Yo, Kaya, where are you?" he called. "I brought petite cakes from Parker's."
Kaya had not tasted anything like cake for years. Tate lifted some books out of the boat, so Kaya moseyed out of the bushes behind him.
"Oh, there you are. Look at this."
He opened the box, and there, arranged neatly, were little cakes, each only an inch square, covered in vanilla icing with a tiny pink rose perched on the top.
"Come on, dig in."
Kaya lifted one, and still not looking at Tate, bit into it, then pushed the rest of it into her mouth, licked her fingers.
"Here."
Tate set the box next to their oak.
"Have all you want. Let's get started. I brought a new book."
And that was that. They went into the lessons, never uttering a word about the other thing. Autumn was coming. The evergreens might not have noticed, but the sycamores did. They flashed thousands of golden leaves across slate-gray skies. Late one afternoon, after the lesson, Tate lingering when he should have left, he and Kaya sat on a log in the woods. She finally asked the question she'd wanted to ask for months.
"Tate, I appreciate your teaching me to read and all those things you gave me, but why'd you do it? Don't you have a girlfriend or somebody like that?"
"Nah. Well, sometimes I do. I had one, but not now. I like being out here in the quiet, and I like the way you're so interested in the marsh, Kaya. Most people don't pay it any attention except to fish. They think it's wasteland that should be drained and developed. People don't understand that most sea creatures, including the very ones they eat, need the marsh."
He didn't mention how he felt sorry for her being alone, that he knew how the kids had treated her for years, how the villagers called her the marsh girl and made up stories about her. Sneaking out to her shack, running through the dark and tagging it had become a regular tradition, an initiation for boys becoming men. What did that say about men? Some of them were already making bets about who would be the first to get her cherry. Things that infuriated and worried him. But that wasn't the main reason he'd left feathers for Kaya in the forest, or why he kept coming to see her. The other words Tate didn't say were his feelings for her, that seemed tangled up between the sweet love for a lost sister and the fiery love for a girl. He couldn't come close to sorting it out himself, but he'd never been hit by a stronger wave. A power of emotions as painful as pleasurable. Poking a grass stalk down an ant hole, she finally asked,
"Where's your ma?"
A breeze wandered through the trees, gently shaking branches. Tate didn't answer.
"You don't have to say nothing," she said.
"Anything."
"You don't have to say anything."
"My mother and little sister died in a car wreck over in Asheville. My sister's name was Carrie Ann."
"Oh, I'm so sorry, Tate. I bet your ma was real nice and pretty."
"Yes, both of them were."
He spoke to the ground between his knees.
"I've never talked about it before. To anybody."
"Me neither,"
Kaya thought. Out loud, she said,
"My ma walked off one day and didn't come back. The mama deer always come back."
"Well, at least you can hope she does. Mine won't come back for sure."
They were silent a moment. Then Tate continued.
"I think..."
But he stopped, looked away. Kaya looked at him, but he stared at the ground. Quiet. She said,
What? You think what? You can say anything to me.
Still, he said nothing. From a patience born from knowing, she waited. Finally, very softly, he said,
I think they went to Asheville to buy my birthday present. There was this certain bike I wanted. Had to have it. The Western Auto didn't carry them, so I think they went to Asheville to buy that bike for me.
That doesn't make it your fault, she said.
I know, but it feels like my fault, Tate said. I don't even remember what kind of bike it was.
Kaya leaned closer to him, not enough to touch, but she felt a sensation, almost like the space between their shoulders had shifted. She wondered if Tate felt it. She wanted to lean in closer, just enough so their arms would gently brush together, to touch, and wondered if Tate would notice. And just at that second, the wind picked up, and thousands upon thousands of yellow sycamore leaves broke from their life support and streamed across the sky. Autumn leaves don't fall. They fly. They take their time and wander on this, their only chance to soar. Reflecting sunlight, they swirled and sailed and fluttered on the wind drafts. Tate sprang from the log and called to her,
See how many leaves you can catch before they hit the ground.
Kaya jumped up, and the two of them leapt and skipped through curtains of falling leaves, reaching their arms wide, snatching them before they fell to the earth. Laughing, Tate dived toward a leaf only inches from the ground, caught it, and rolled over, holding his trophy in the air. Kaya threw her hands up, releasing all the leaves she had rescued back into the wind. As she ran back through them, they caught like gold in her hair. Then, as she whirled around, she bumped into Tate, who had stood, and they froze, staring into each other's eyes. They stopped laughing. He took her shoulders, hesitated an instant, then kissed her lips as the leaves rained and danced around them as silently as snow. She knew nothing about kissing and held her head and lips stiff. They broke away and looked at each other, wondering where that had come from and what to do next. He lifted a leaf gently from her hair and dropped it to the ground. Her heart beat wildly. Of all the ragged loves she'd known from wayward family, none had felt like this.
Am I your girlfriend now? She asked.
He smiled.
Do you want to be?
Yes.
You might be too young, he said.
But I know feathers. I bet the other girls don't know feathers.
All right, then.
And he kissed her again. This time she tilted her head to the side and her lips softened. And for the first time in her life, her heart was full. Chapter 18, White Canoe, 1960. Now, every new word began with a squeal, every sentence a race. Tate grabbing Kaya, the two of them tumbling, half childlike, half not, through sour weed, red with autumn.
Be serious a second, he said. The only way to get multiplication tables is to memorize them.
He wrote 12 by 12 = 144 in the sand, but she ran past him, dived into the breaking surf, down to the calm, and swam until he followed, into a place where gray-blue light beams slanted through the quiet and highlighted their forms. Sleek as porpoises. Later, sandy and salty, they rolled across the beach, arms tight around each other as if they were one. The next afternoon, he motored into her lagoon but stayed in his boat after beaching. A large basket covered in a red checkered cloth sat at his feet.
"What's that? What'd you bring?"
she asked. "A surprise. Go on, get in." They flowed through the slow-moving channels into the sea, then south to a tiny half-moon bay. After wrist-flicking the blanket onto the sand, he placed the covered basket on it, and as they sat, he lifted the cloth.
"Happy birthday, Kaya," he said. "You're 15.
A two-tiered bakery cake, tall as a hat box and decorated with shells of pink icing, rose from the basket, her name scripted on top. Presents, wrapped in colorful paper and tied with bows, surrounded the cake. She stared, flabbergasted, her mouth open. No one had wished her happy birthday since Ma left. No one had ever given her a store-bought cake with her name on it. She'd never had presents in real wrapping paper with ribbons.
"How'd you know my birthday?"
Having no calendar, she had no idea it was today.
"I read it in your Bible."
While she pleaded for him not to cut through her name, he sliced enormous pieces of cake and plopped them on paper plates. Staring into each other's eyes, they broke off bites and stuffed them in their mouths, smacking loudly, licking fingers, laughing through icing-smeared grins. Eating cake the way it should be eaten, the way everybody wants to eat it.
"Want to open your presents?"
he smiled. "The first, a small magnifying glass,
so you can see the fine details of insect wings.
Second, a plastic clasp, painted silver and decorated with a rhinestone seagull,
for your hair."
Somewhat awkwardly, he pulled some locks behind her ear and clipped the beret in place. She touched it. More beautiful than Ma's. The last present was in a larger box, and Kaya opened it to find 10 jars of oil paint, tins of watercolors, and different sized brushes.
"For your paintings."
Kaya picked up each color, each brush.
"I can get more when you need them. Even canvas from Sea Oaks."
She dipped her head.
"Thank you, Tate."
"Easy does it. Go slow now,"
Scupper called out as Tate, surrounded by fishing nets, oil rags, and preening pelicans, powered the winch. The bow of the cherry pie bobbled on the cradle, gave a shudder, then glided onto the underwater rails at Pete's boatyard, the lopsided pier and rusted-out boathouse, the only haul-out in Barkley Cove.
"Okay, good. She's on. Bring her out."
Tate eased more power to the winch, and the boat crawled up the track and into dry dock. They secured her in cables and set about scraping blotchy barnacles from her hull as crystal-sharp arias of Mitsakoryus rose from the record player. They'd have to apply primer, then the annual coat of red paint. Tate's mother had chosen the color, and Scupper would never change it. Once in a while, Scupper stopped scraping and waved his large arms to the music's sinuous shape. Now, early winter, Scupper paid Tate adult wages to work for him after school and on weekends. But Tate couldn't get out to Kaya's as much. He didn't mention this to his dad. He'd never mentioned anything about Kaya to his dad. They hacked at barnacles until dark, until even Scupper's arms burned.
"I'm too tired to cook, and I reckon you are too. Let's grab some grub at the diner on the way home."
Nodding at everyone, there not being one person they didn't know, they sat at a corner table. Both ordered the special: chicken fried steak, mash and gravy, turnips and coleslaw, biscuits, pecan pie with ice cream. At the next table, a family of four joined hands and lowered their heads as the father said a blessing out loud. At Amen, they kissed the air, squeezed hands, and passed the cornbread. Scupper said,
Now, son, I know this job's keeping you from things. That's the way it is. But you didn't go to the homecoming dance or anything last fall, and I don't want you to miss all of it, this being your last year. There's that big dance at the pavilion coming up. You asking a girl? Nah, I might go. Not sure. But there's nobody I want to ask. There's not one single girl in school you'd go with? Nope. Well, then.
Scupper leaned back as the waitress put down his plate of food.
Thank you, Betty. You sure heaped it up good.
Betty moved around and set down Tate's plate, piled even higher.
Y'all eat up now, she said. There's more where this come from. The special's all you can eat.
She smiled at Tate before walking with an extra hip swing back to the kitchen. Tate said,
The girls at school are silly. All they talk about is hairdos and high heels. Well, now, that's what girls do. Sometimes you gotta take things as they are.
Maybe.
Now, son, I don't pay much mind to idle talk. Never have done. But there's a regular riptide of gossip saying you've got something going with that girl in the marsh.
Tate threw up his hands.
Now, hold on, hold on.
Scupper continued.
I don't believe all the stories about her. She's probably nice. But take a care, son. You don't want to go starting a family too early. You get my meaning, don't you?
Keeping his voice low, Tate hissed. First you say you don't believe those stories about her, then you say I shouldn't start a family, showing you do believe she's that kind of girl. Well, let me tell you something, she's not. She's more pure and innocent than any of those girls you'd have me go to the dance with. Oh, man, some of the girls in this town? Well, let's just say they hunt in packs, take no prisoners. And yes, I've been going out to see Kaya some. You know why? I'm teaching her how to read because people in this town are so mean to her she couldn't even go to school.
That's fine, Tate. That's good of you. But please understand, it's my job to say things like this. It may not be pleasant and all for us to talk about, but parents have to warn their kids about things. That's my job, so don't get huffy about it.
I know, Tate mumbled while buttering a biscuit, feeling very huffy.
Come on now, let's get another helping, then some of that pecan pie.
After the pie came, Scupper said,
Well, since we've talked about things we never mention, I might as well say something else on my mind.
Tate rolled his eyes at his pie. Scupper continued,
I want you to know, son, how proud I am of you. All on your own, you've studied the marsh life, done real well at school, applied for college to get a degree in science, and got accepted. I'm just not the kind to speak on such things much. But I'm mighty proud of you, son. All right?
Yeah, all right. Later in his room, Tate recited from his favorite poem, Oh, when shall I see the dusky lake and the white canoe of my dear? Around the work, as best he could, Tate got out to Kaya's, but could never stay long. Sometimes boating 40 minutes for a 10-minute beach walk, holding hands, kissing a lot, not wasting a minute, boating back. He wanted to touch her breasts, would kill just to look at them. Lying awake at night, he thought of her thighs, how soft yet firm they must be. To think beyond her thighs sent him roiling in the sheets. But she was so young and timid. If he did things wrong, it might affect her somehow. Then he'd be worse than the boys who only talked about snagging her. His desire to protect her was as strong as the other. Sometimes. On every trip to Kaya's, Tate took school or library books, especially on marsh creatures and biology. Her progress was startling. She could read anything now, he said. And once you can read anything, you can learn everything. It was up to her.
Nobody's come close to filling their brains, he said. We're all like giraffes, not using their necks to reach the higher leaves. Alone for hours, by the light of the lantern, Kaya read how plants and animals change over time to adjust to the ever-shifting earth. How some cells divide and specialize into lungs or hearts, while others remain uncommitted as stem cells in case they're needed later. Birds sing mostly at dawn because the cool, moist air of morning carries their songs and their meanings much farther. All her life, she'd seen these marvels at eye level, so nature's ways came easily to her. Within all the worlds of biology, she searched for an explanation of why a mother would leave her offspring. One cold day, long after all the sycamore leaves had fallen, Tate stepped out of his boat with a present wrapped in red and green paper.
I don't have anything for you, she said as he held the present out for her. I didn't know it's Christmas.
It's not, he smiled. Not by a long shot, he lied. Come on, it's not much.
Carefully, she took the paper off to find a second-hand Webster's dictionary.
Oh, Tate, thank you.
Look inside, he said.
Tucked in the P section was a pelican feather, forget-me-not blossoms pressed between two pages of the F's, a dried mushroom under M. So many treasures were stashed among the pages, the book would not completely close.
I'll try to come back the day after Christmas. Maybe I can bring a turkey dinner.
He kissed her goodbye. After he left, she swore out loud. Her first chance since Ma left to give a gift to someone she loved, and she'd missed it. A few days later, shivering in the sleeveless peach-colored chiffon dress, she waited for Tate on the lagoon shore. Pacing, she clutched her present for him. A head tuft from a male cardinal, wrapped in the paper he had used. As soon as he stepped out of his boat, she stuck the present into his hands, insisting he open it there, so he did.
Thank you, Kaya. I don't have one.
Her Christmas complete.
Now let's get you inside. You must be freezing in that dress.
The kitchen was warm from the wood stove, but still he suggested she change into a sweater and jeans. Working together, they heated the food he'd brought. Turkey, cornbread dressing, cranberry sauce, sweet potato casserole, and pumpkin pie. All leftovers from Christmas dinner at the diner with his dad. Kaya had made biscuits. And they ate at the kitchen table, which she had decorated with wild holly and seashells.
I'll wash up, she said,
as she poured hot water from the wood stove into the basin.
I'll help you.
And he came up behind her and put his arms around her waist. She leaned her head back against his chest, eyes closed. Slowly his fingers moved under her sweater, across her sleek stomach, toward her breasts. As usual, she wore no bra, and his fingers circled her nipples. His touch lingered there. But a sensation spread down her body as though his hands had moved between her legs. A hollowness that urgently needed filling pulsed through her, but she didn't know what to do, what to say, so pushed back.
It's okay,
he said, and just held her there, both of them breathing deep. The sun, still shy and submissive to winter, peeped in now and then between days of mean wind and bitter rain. Then one afternoon, just like that, spring elbowed her way in for good. The day warmed and the sky shone as if polished. Kaya spoke quietly as she and Tate walked along the grassy bank of a deep creek, overhung with tall sweet gum trees. Suddenly he grabbed her hand, shushing her. Her eyes followed his to the water's edge, where a bullfrog, 6 inches wide, hunkered under foliage. A common enough sight, except this frog was completely and brilliantly white. Tate and Kaya grinned at each other and watched until he disappeared in one silent, big-legged leap. Still, they were quiet as they backed away into the brush another 5 yards. Kaya put her hands over her mouth and giggled, bounced away from him in a girlish jig, in a body not quite so girlish. Tate watched her for a second, no longer thinking about frogs. He stepped toward her purposely. His expression stopped her in front of a broad oak. He took her shoulders and pushed her firmly against the tree. Holding her arms along her sides, he kissed her, his groin pushing against hers. Since Christmas, they had kissed and explored slowly, not like this. He had always taken the lead, but had watched her questioningly for signs to desist. Not like now. He pulled away, the deep golden brown layers of his eyes boring into hers. Slowly, he unbuttoned her shirt and pulled it off, exposing her breasts. He took his time to examine them with his eyes and fingers, circling her nipples. Then he unzipped her shorts and pulled them down until they dropped to the ground. Almost naked for the first time in front of him, she panted and moved her hands to cover herself. Gently, he moved her hands away and took his time looking at her body. Her groin throbbed as if all her blood had surged there. He stepped out of his shorts and, still staring at her, pushed his erection against her. When she turned away in shyness, he lifted her chin and said, "Look at me. Look me in the eyes, Kaya."
"Tate. Tate."
She reached out, trying to kiss him. But he held her back, forcing only her eyes to take him in. She didn't know raw nakedness could bring such want. He whispered his hands against her inner thighs, and instinctively she stepped each foot to the side slightly. His fingers moved between her legs and slowly massaged parts of her she never knew existed. She threw her head back and whimpered. Abruptly, he pushed away from her and stepped back.
"God, Kaya, I'm sorry. I'm sorry."
"Tate, please. I want to."
"Not like this, Kaya."
"Why not? Why not like this?"
She reached for his shoulders and tried to pull him back to her.
"Why not?"
she said again. He picked up her clothes and dressed her, not touching her where she wanted, where parts of her body still pounded. Then he lifted her and carried her to the creek bank, put her down, and sat beside her.
"Kaya, I want you more than anything. I want you forever. But you're too young. You're only 15.
"So what? You're only 4 years older. It's not like you're suddenly Mr. Know-it-all adult."
"Yes, but I can't get pregnant. And I can't be damaged as easily by this. I won't do it, Kaya. Because I love you."
Love. There was nothing about the word she understood.
"You still think I'm a little girl," she whined.
"Kaya, you're sounding more and more like a little girl every second."
But he smiled as he said it, and pulled her closer.
"When, then, if not now? When can we?"
"Just not yet."
They were quiet for a moment, and then she asked,
"How did you know what to do?"
Head down, shy again.
"The same way you did."
One afternoon in May, as they walked from the lagoon, he said,
"You know, I'm going away soon. To college."
He had spoken of going to Chapel Hill, but Kaya had pushed it from her mind, knowing at least they had summer.
"When? Not now."
"Not long. A few weeks."
"But why? I thought college started in the fall.
I got accepted for a job in a biology lab on campus. I can't pass that up. So I'm starting summer quarter.
Of all the people who left her, only Jody had said goodbye. Everyone else had walked away forever, but this didn't feel any better. Her chest burned.
I'll come back as much as I can. It's not that far, really. Less than a day by bus.
She sat quiet. Finally, she said,
Why do you have to go, Tate? Why can't you stay here? Shrimp like your dad.
Kaya, you know why. I just can't do that. I want to study the marsh. Be a research biologist.
They had reached the beach and sat on the sand.
Then what? There are no jobs like that here. You'll never come home again.
Yes, I will. I won't leave you, Kaya. I promise. I'll come back to you.
She jumped to her feet, startling the plovers, who flew up, squawking. She ran from the beach into the woods. Tate ran after her, but as soon as he reached the trees, he stopped, looked around. She had already lost him. But just in case she stood in earshot, he called out,
Kaya, you can't run from every whip stitch. Sometimes you have to discuss things, face things.
Then, with less patience,
Damn it, Kaya! Damn it to hell!
A week later, Kaya heard Tate's boat whirring across her lagoon and hid behind a bush. As he eased through the channel, the heron lifted on slow silver wings. Some part of her wanted to run, but she stepped onto the shore, waiting.
Hey, he said.
For once, he didn't wear a cap, and his wild blonde curls wafted about his tanned face. It seemed that in the last few months, his shoulders had widened into those of a man.
Hey.
He stepped from the boat, took her hand, and led her to the reading log, where they sat.
Turns out I'm leaving sooner than I thought. I'm skipping the graduation ceremony so I can start my job. Kaya, I've come to say goodbye.
Even his voice seemed manlike, ready for a more serious world. She didn't answer, but sat looking away from him, her throat pulled in tight. He placed two bags of school and library rejects, mostly science books, at her feet. She wasn't sure she could speak. She wanted him to take her again to the place of the white frog. In case he never came back, she wanted him to take her there now.
I'm going to miss you, Kaya. Every day, all day.
You might forget me. When you get busy with all that college stuff and see all those pretty girls.
I'll never forget you. Ever. You take care of the marsh till I get back. You hear? And be careful.
I will.
I mean it now, Kaya. Watch out for folks. Don't let strangers get near you.
I think I can hide or outrun anybody.
Yes, I believe you can. I'll come home in about a month, I promise. For the 4th of July. I'll be back before you know it.
She didn't answer, and he stood, jammed his hands into his jeans pockets. She stood next to him, but they both looked away into the trees. He took her shoulders and kissed her for a long time.
Goodbye, Kaya.
For a moment, she looked somewhere over his shoulder and then into his eyes, a chasm she knew to its greatest depths.
Goodbye, Tate.
Without another word, he got in his boat and motored across the lagoon. Just before entering the thick brambles of the channel, he turned and waved. She lifted her hand high above her head and then touched it to her heart. Chapter 19. Something Going On. 1969. The morning after reading the second lab report, the eighth day since finding Chase Andrews's body in the swamp, Deputy Perdue pushed open the door to the sheriff's office with his foot and stepped inside. He carried two paper cups of coffee and a bag of hot donuts, just pulled from the fryer.
"Oh, man, the smell of Parker's,"
Ed said as Joe placed the goods on the desk. Each man dug an enormous donut from the brown paper bag splotched with grease stains, smacked loudly, licked glazed fingers. Speaking over each other, both men announced,
"Well, I got something." "Go ahead," Ed said. "I got it from several sources that Chase had something going on in the marsh." "Going on? What do you mean?" "Not sure, but some guys at the doggone say about 4 years ago he started going out to the marsh a lot by himself. Was real secretive about it. He'd still go fishing or boating with his friends, but made a lot of trips alone. I was thinking maybe he got himself mixed up with some potheads or worse. Got over his head with some nasty drug thug. You lie down with dogs, you get up with fleas. Or in this case, not get up at all. I don't know. He was such an athlete. Hard to picture him getting mixed up in drugs," the sheriff said. "Former athlete, and anyhow, lots of 'em get tangled up in drugs. When the grand days of hero dry up, they gotta get a high from somewheres else. Or maybe he had a woman out there." "I just don't know of any ladies out there that'd be his type. He only hung out with the so-called Barkley elite, not trash." "Well, if he thought of himself as slumming, maybe that's why he was so quiet about it." "True," the sheriff said. "Anyway, whatever he had going on out there, it opens up a whole new side of his life we didn't know about. Let's do some snooping. See what he was up to." "You said you got something, too?" "Not sure what. Chase's mother called. Said she had something important to tell us about the case. Something to do with a shell necklace he wore all the time. She's sure it's a clue. Wants to come in here to tell us about it." "When's she coming?" "This afternoon. Pretty soon." "It'd be nice to have a real clue. Beats walking around looking for some guy wearing a red wool sweater with a motive attached. We gotta admit, if this was a murder, it was a clever one. The marsh chewed up and swallowed all the evidence, if there was any. Do we have time for lunch before Patty Love gets here?" "Sure. And the special's fried pork chops. Blackberry pie."
Chapter 20. July 4th, 1961. Dressed in the now too short peach chiffon, Kaya walked barefoot to the lagoon on July 4th and sat on the reading log. Cruel heat shrugged off the last wisps of fog, and a dense humidity she could barely breathe filled the air. Now and then, she knelt to the lagoon and splashed cool water on her neck, all the while listening for the hum of Tate's boat. She didn't mind waiting. She read the books he'd given her. The day dragged itself by minutes, the sun getting stuck in the middle. The log hardened, so she settled on the ground, her back against a tree. Finally, hungry, she rushed back to the shack for a leftover sausage and biscuit. Ate fast, afraid he would come while she quit her post. The muggy afternoon rallied mosquitoes. No boat, no Tate. At dusk, she stood straight and still and silent as a stork, staring at the empty, quiet channel, breathing hurt. Stepping out of the dress, she eased into the water and swam in the dark coolness, the water sliding over her skin, releasing heat from her core. She pulled from the lagoon and sat on a mossy patch of the bank, nude until she dried, until the moon slipped beneath the earth. Then, carrying her clothes, walked inside. She waited the next day. Each hour warmed until noon, blistered after midday, throbbed past sunset. Later, the moon threw hope across the water, but that died too. Another sunrise, another white-hot noon. Sunset again. All hope gone to neutral. Her eyes shifted listlessly, and though she listened for Tate's boat, she was no longer coiled. The lagoon smelled of life and death at once, an organic jumbling of promise and decay. Frogs croaked. Dully, she watched fireflies scribbling across the night. She never collected lightning bugs in bottles. You learn a lot more about something when it's not in a jar. Jody had taught her that the female firefly flickers the light under her tail to signal to the male that she's ready to mate. Each species of firefly has its own language of flashes. As Kaya watched, some females signed dot, 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 dash, flying a zigzag dance, while others flashed dash, dash, dot in a different dance pattern. The males, of course, knew the signals of their species and flew only to those females. Then, as Jody had put it, they rubbed their bottoms together like most things did, so they could produce young. Suddenly, Kaya sat up and paid attention. One of the females had changed her code. First, she flashed the proper sequence of dashes and dots, attracting a male of her species, and they mated. Then she flickered a different signal, and a male of a different species flew to her. Reading her message, the second male was convinced he'd found a willing female of his own kind and hovered above her to mate. But suddenly, the female firefly reached up, grabbed him with her mouth, and ate him, chewing all six legs and both wings. Kaya watched others. The females got what they wanted, first a mate, then a meal, just by changing their signals. Kaya knew judgment had no place here. Evil was not in play, just life pulsing on, even at the expense of some of the players. Biology sees right and wrong as the same color in different light. She waited another hour for Tate, and finally walked toward the shack. The next morning, swearing at the shreds of cruel hope, she went back to the lagoon. Sitting at the water's edge, she listened for the sound of a boat chugging down the channel or across the distant estuaries. At noon, she stood and screamed, "Tate! Tate! No! No!" Then dropped to her knees, her face against the mud. She felt a strong pull out from under her, a tide she knew well. Chapter 21 Coop 1961 Hot wind rattled the palmetto fronds like small dry bones. For 3 days after giving up on Tate, Kaya didn't get out of bed. Drugged by despair and heat, she tossed in clothes and sheets damp from sweat, her skin sticky. She sent her toes on missions to scout for cool spots between the sheets, but they found none. She didn't note the time of moonrise or when a great horned owl took a diurnal dive at a blue jay. From bed, she heard the marsh beyond and the lifting of blackbird wings, but didn't go to it. She heard from the crying songs of the gulls above the beach calling to her. But for the first time in her life, did not go to them. She hoped the pain from ignoring them would displace the tear in her heart. It did not. Listless, she wondered what she had done to send everyone away. Her own ma, her sisters, her whole family, Jody, and now Tate. Her most poignant memories were unknown dates of family members disappearing down the lane. The last of a white scarf trailing through the leaves. A pile of socks left on a floor mattress. Tate and life and love had been the same thing.
Now there was no Tate.
Why, Tate? Why?
She mumbled into the sheets.
You were supposed to be different. To stay. You said you loved me. But there is no such thing. There is no one on earth you can count on.
From somewhere very deep, she made herself a promise never to trust or love anyone again. She'd always found the muscle and heart to pull herself from the mire, to take the next step, no matter how shaky. But where had all that grit brought her? She drifted in and out of thin sleep. Suddenly, the sun, full, bright, and glaring, struck her face. Never in her life had she slept until midday. She heard a soft rustling sound, and raising herself onto her elbows, saw a raven-sized Cooper's hawk standing on the other side of the screen door, peering in. For the first time in days, an interest stirred in her. She roused herself as the hawk took wing. Finally, she made a mush of hot water and grits and headed to the beach to feed the gulls. When she broke onto the beach, all of them swirled and dived in flurries, and she dropped to her knees and tossed the food on the sand. As they crowded around her, she felt their feathers brushing her arms and thighs and threw her head back, smiling with them, even as tears streamed her cheeks. For a month after July 4th, Kaya did not leave her place, did not go into the marsh or to Jumpin's for gas or supplies. She lived on dried fish, mussels, oysters, grits, and greens. When all her shelves were empty, she finally motored to Jumpin's for supplies, but didn't chat with him as usual. Did her business and left him standing staring after her. Needing people ended in hurt. A few mornings later, the Cooper's hawk was back on her steps, peering at her through the screen.
How odd, she thought, cocking her head at him. Hey, Coop.
With a little hop, he lifted, made a flyby, then soared high into the clouds. Watching him, at last Kaya said to herself,
I have to get back into the marsh.
And she took the boat out, easing along the channels and slipstreams, searching for bird nests, feathers, or shells, for the first time since Tate abandoned her. Even so, she couldn't avoid thoughts of him. The intellectual fascinations or the pretty girls of Chapel Hill had drawn him in. She couldn't imagine college women, but whatever form they took would be better than a tangled-haired, barefoot muscle monger who lived in a shack. By the end of August, her life once more found its footing. Boat, collect, paint. Months passed. She only went to Jumpin's when low supplies demanded, but spoke very little to him. Her collections matured, categorized methodically by order, genus, and species, by age according to bone wear, by size in millimeters of feathers, or by the most fragile hues of greens. The science and art entwined in each other's strengths. The colors, the light, the species, the life. Weaving a masterpiece of knowledge and beauty that filled every corner of her shack. Her world. She grew with them, the trunk of the vine, alone, but holding all the wonders together. But just as her collection grew, so did her loneliness. A pain as large as her heart lived in her chest. Nothing eased it. Not the gulls, not a splendid sunset, not the rarest of shells. Months turned into a year. The lonely became larger than she could hold. She wished for someone's voice, presence, touch, but wished more to protect her heart. Months passed into another year, then another. Part 2. The Swamp. Chapter 22. Same Tide. 1965. 19 years old, legs longer,
eyes larger and seemingly blacker. Kaya sat on Point Beach, watching sand crabs bury themselves backward into the swash. Suddenly, from the south, she heard voices and jumped to her feet. The group of kids, now young adults, she'd watched occasionally through the years, ambled toward her, tossing a football, running and kicking the surf. Anxious they would see her, she loped to the trees, sand tearing from her heels, and hid behind the broad trunk of an oak tree, knowing how odd this made her.
"Not much has changed," she thought. "Them laughing, me holing up like a sand crab."
A wild thing ashamed of her own freakish ways. Tall, skinny blonde, ponytail freckle face, always wears pearls and round chubby cheeks, romped the beach, tangled in laughs and hugs. On her rare trips to the village, she'd heard their slurs.
"Yeah, the marsh girl gets her clothes from colored people. Has to trade muscles for grits."
Yet after all these years, they were still a group of friends. That was something. Silly looking on the outside, yes. But as Mabel had said several times, they were a sure troop.
"You need some girlfriends, hon, 'cause they're forever, without a vow. A clutch of women's the most tender, most tough place on earth."
Kaya found herself laughing softly with them as they kicked salt water on one another. Then, shrieking, they rushed as one into the deeper surf. Kaya's smile faded when they pulled themselves out of the water and into their traditional group hug. Their squeals made Kaya's silence even louder. Their togetherness tugged at her loneliness. But she knew being labeled as marsh trash kept her behind the oak tree. Her eyes shifted to the tallest guy. Wearing khaki shorts and no shirt, he threw the football. Kaya watched the cords of muscles bunching on his back, his tan shoulders. She knew he was Chase Andrews, and over the years, ever since he nearly ran her over on his bicycle, she'd seen him with these friends on the beach, walking into the diner for milkshakes, or at Jumpin's buying gas. Now, as the group came closer, she watched only him. When another tossed the ball, he ran to catch it and came close to her tree, his bare feet digging in the hot sand. As he raised his arm to throw, he happened to glance back and caught Kaya's eyes. After passing the ball, without giving any sign to the others, he turned and held her gaze. His hair was black, like hers, but his eyes were pale blue, his face strong, striking. A shadow smile formed on his lips. Then he walked back to the others, shoulders relaxed. Sure. But he had noticed her. Had held her eyes. Her breath froze as a heat flowed through her. She tracked them, mostly him, down the shore. Her mind looking one way, her desire the other. Her body watched Chase Andrews. Not her heart. The next day she returned. Same tide, different time, but no one was there. Just noisy sandpipers and wave-riding sand crabs. She tried to force herself to avoid that beach and stick to the marsh, searching for bird nests and feathers. Stay safe, feeding grits to gulls. Life had made her an expert at mashing feelings into a storable size. But loneliness has a compass of its own. And she went back to the beach to look for him the next day, and the next. Late one afternoon, after watching for Chase Andrews, Kaya walks from her shack and lies back on a sliver of beach, slick from the last wave. She stretches her arms over her head, brushing them against the wet sand, and extends her legs, toes pointed. Eyes closed, she rolls slowly toward the sea. Her hips and arms leave slight indentions in the glistening sand, brightening and then dimming as she moves. Rolling nearer the waves, She senses the ocean's roar through the length of her body and feels the question,
when will the sea touch me? Where will it touch me first?
The foamy surge rushes the shore, reaching toward her. Tingling with expectancy, she breathes deep, turns more and more slowly. With each revolution, just before her face sweeps the sand, she lifts her head gently and takes in the sun-salt smell.
I am close, very close. It is coming. When will I feel it?
A fever builds. The sand wetter beneath her, the rumble of surf louder. Even slower, by inches she moves, waiting for the touch.
Soon. Soon.
Almost feeling it before it comes. She wants to open her eyes to peek, to see how much longer. But she resists, squinting her lids even tighter, the sky bright behind them, giving no hints. Suddenly she shrieks as the power rushes beneath her, fondles her thighs, between her legs, flows along her back, swirling under her head, pulling her hair in inky strands. She rolls faster into the deepening wave, against streaming shells and ocean bits, the water embracing her. Pushing against the sea's strong body, she is grasped, held, not alone. Kaya sits up and opens her eyes to the ocean foaming around her in soft white patterns, always changing. Since Chase had glanced at her on the beach, she'd already gone to Jumpin's Wharf twice in 1 week. Not admitting to herself that she hoped to see Chase there, being noticed by someone had lit a social cord, and now she asked Jumpin,
"How's Mabel doing anyway? Are any of your grandkids home?"
Like the old days. Jumpin noticed the change, knew better than to comment.
"Yes, sirree. Got four with us right now. House full up with giggles and I don't know what all."
But a few mornings later, when Kaya motored to the wharf, Jumpin was nowhere to be seen. Brown pelicans, hunched up on posts, eyed her as though they were minding shop. Kaya smiled at them. A touch on her shoulder made her jump.
"Hi."
She turned to see Chase standing behind her. She dropped her smile.
"I'm Chase Andrews."
His eyes, ice-packed blue, pierced her own. He seemed completely comfortable to stare into her. She said nothing but shifted her weight.
"I've seen you around some. You know, over the years in the marsh. What's your name?"
For a moment, he thought she wasn't going to speak. Maybe she was dumb or spoke a primal language like some said. A less self-assured man might have walked away.
"Kaya?"
Obviously, he didn't remember their sidewalk bicycle encounter or know her in any way except as the marsh girl.
"Kaya, that's different, but nice. You want to go for a picnic? In my boat? This Sunday?"
She looked past him, taking time to evaluate his words, but couldn't see them to an end. Here was a chance to be with someone. Finally, she said,
"Okay."
He told her to meet him at the Oak Peninsula north of Point Beach at noon. Then he stepped into his blue and white ski boat, metal bits gleaming from every possible surface, and accelerated away. She turned at the sound of more footsteps. Jumpin scurried up the dock.
"Hi, Miss Kaya. Sorry, I've been toting empty crates over yonder. Fill her up?"
Kaya nodded. On the way home, she cut the motor and drifted, the shore in sight. Leaning against the old knapsack, watching the sky, she recited poetry by heart, as she did sometimes. One of her favorites was John Masefield's Sea Fever.
"All I ask is a windy day with the white clouds flying, and the flung spray and the blown spume and the seagulls crying."
Kaya recalled a poem written by a lesser-known poet, Amanda Hamilton, published recently in the local newspaper she'd bought at the Piggly Wiggly.
Trap